right. It's welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. It means Fridays with Sandy Williams. Sandy, I think I'm sitting up in a deer stand out. I didn't hear you.
I said you put your coat back on again, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Let me ask you, Sandy. The Defense Department fails another audit, but it says it's making progress. Just listen to this. The Defense Department has failed its fifth ever audit. They've only had five in all the years that the Defense Department has been going on. They've only attempted to audit itself five times, unable to account for more than half of its assets, but the effort is being viewed as a teachable moment, according to the chief financial officer.
Yeah, what's the number? What is their total number of assets? It's trillions, right?
Yeah, after 1,600 auditors combed through the Department of Defense's $3.5 trillion in assets and $3.7 trillion in liabilities. So they're in the hole. They've got $3.7 trillion in liabilities. Officials found that the department couldn't account for about 61% of its assets. Sandy, you've been a business guy. You know, been around the block. Could any other business run a business like that?
No. I mean, you know, the fact is that audits are done for a couple of reasons. They're done to make sure you've got discipline in the process. They're done to make sure that you know what you've got. You know, it's pretty important in the military to know the assets that you've got and where they are, because you might need them when you go to war, actually. And it's also important to make sure that you don't have corruption. And here you've got a budget that's $850 billion a year. It's a wash in expenditures. It's a place where if there was going to be perfidy, you know, there was going to be some malfeasance, the kind of money that would spill out of that could be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So discipline would be very important. This whole problem was first highlighted by Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. I don't know if anyone remembers back when William Rumsfeld was the Secretary of Defense, and he pointed out that we had more than $1 trillion of assets we couldn't find. And that was news for about 10 days. And then everyone in Washington decided that it was really it was more politically dangerous to start investigating the Pentagon than it was to just lay low, because, you know, the good housekeeping stamp of patriotic approval that's required of every politician, I think, requires that they wear a flag in their lapel pin, that everyone stand up at the national anthem, that nobody questions expenditures that are to be approved in the Pentagon's budget year to year, and that we don't investigate it. You know, the last politician that I'm familiar with that decided to get to investigate expenditures by the Pentagon was William Proxmire, the sort of quixotic, eccentric senator from Wisconsin who would come out regularly with the Golden Fleece Award. And it would typically be awarded to the Pentagon for, you know, $26,000 hammers or golden toilets that were, you know, the things that were extravagantly expensive that he could find in the budget with a quick perusal. But everyone in Washington knows that if you want to hide a government expenditure, the easiest place to hide it is to put it in the defense budget.
You know, Sandy, The sheer size and scope of the department, which makes up more than half of the U.S. discretionary spending. Half.
Right.
You know.
And we gave it a blank check. And that blank check, which we give for this reason of the required stamp of patriotism, costs us the capability of even discussing, for instance, universal daycare or a bunch of the things that could well be very important to the people. And we have trouble doing it because that discretionary money is all being spent in this black hole. It is apparently an accounting black hole.
You know, Sandy, here, this is at a time that you heard Ron Johnson and Scott from Florida, what is his name, Tim, the senator, who was talking about Social Security and Medicare and discretionary spending. And let's look at this every year, right? Let's put it up every year so we can look at it and see what's going on. But yet you're not willing to look at something like that? It's an insult.
I mean, I think that the biggest problem, you know, we have money in politics, and some of that money in politics does surround really the military-industrial complex, the fact that we've got so many jobs in our economy that relate indirectly or directly to that $850 billion a year we're spending in the defense budget that, you know, it's become off limits for discussion, and that money is gets in the way of our capacity to do all these other things.
You know, listen to this. In December 2017, and this is for the audience, defense officials set out to scrutinize the Department of Justice's books in 2017, the first comprehensive audit of the agency in its history. We just attempted to do that 5 years ago. The effort failed the next year and the four that followed. The agency had never expected to pass. However, due to accounting issues, officials said it could take years to fix because accounting records needed to complete the assessment were not available. All five audits received a disclaimer of opinion, though there have been improvements each time. All the other entities associated with the government, Sandy, their audits have to come back clean, right? I mean, if their audits came back bad, they would be in danger of not getting the resources that they got the year before, right? Wouldn't there be some penalty?
Yeah, the purpose of the audits is to shine the bright light of disclosure to the public on what's going on in our government. And here we have a process with our defense budget that means that we've got over a $1 trillion black hole of unknown assets, which really means that that we just have it's out of control. It's out of budgetary control. The whole Defense Department.
So listen to some of the things they found. What they found were several new weaknesses in how the Department of Defense accounted for its assets, which include nearly 2.9 million military personnel, equipment and weapons, including 19,700 aircraft and more than 290 ships, and physical items, including buildings, roads, and fences, on 4,860 sites worldwide. You mean to tell me they don't know where the all the airplanes are? They don't know where all the people are? They don't know the build? I mean, come on, Sandy. To break up the work, the department holds 27 separate smaller audits and then combines the information to get the bigger picture. Sandy, they don't know where all the planes are. They don't know where all everything is. They don't know. And yet they continue to build, right? I mean, if you don't know where these things are, Sandy, why do you continue to build them?
Well, it's gross. And I do understand that some things that go over many, many years and with the changes that we've had in technology and record keeping, I know that, for instance, local utilities would have trouble telling you where all their gas lines are. And, you know, you can lose track of infrastructure. But the real problem at the Pentagon is not that they don't know where their airplanes are. The real problem with the Pentagon is that nobody is looking over their shoulder carefully auditing what they're doing on an ongoing basis. If they had careful ongoing annual audits, then they wouldn't be $1 trillion off when this time came.
So no fear for the CEO to get fired, right?
Yeah, no fear to get fired, and really no fear about essentially getting caught in the process of potential, and by shenanigans, I don't mean necessarily corruption, but people taking money out in their pocket, but just handling things in a manner that is not subject to oversight. It's one of the problems that the United States has with everything they do that's cloaked in secrecy. Because when it's cloaked in secrecy, there's the capacity for people to do what they want rather than what they're required to do.
So you think... go ahead, Sandy.
Oh, no, I'm just saying that so that we have the issue, an oversight with respect to our CIA and our secret agencies, and the defense budget in many ways is an extension of that, because so much of what happens in the defense budget is deemed to be classified and beyond oversight by the public. And when it gets beyond oversight by the public, the question is, whose oversight does it have?
You know, Sandy, all of these auditors, that almost by itself, to think about the amount of people who are doing that auditing, they're probably auditing year round, huh? I mean, I don't think it's possible to audit something that massive, you know, in a matter of months.
No, and comprehensive audit. Well, first of all, anything that big should have an audit going on all of the time. It undoubtedly does have internal audit processes in place that do operate all the time. The point is, they don't operate well enough, because what you're supposed to be able to do with ongoing controls is sum them up, and at the end of the years, they should bring you to a footing that tells you pretty much where you're at, and help the auditors complete a process quickly.
All right, listen, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You know, Sandy, things are changing quickly with the war in Ukraine and Russia. And Vladimir Zelensky, the president, is starting to see that, you know, even though we've talked about how they had the upper hand, Russia's really, you know, unloading, you know, these weapons on the infrastructure. And we're right in the winter is coming, and you know, they don't think they're going to be able to fix, the electric grid. And so, you know, Russia now has found a sweet spot. And I hate to use it in that terms because it's war and people are suffering. But they do know that we can shut down their, you know, their structure. And so, you know, I think Zelensky he's realizing that now. How do we stop the Russia has, really increased their attack? And, you know, even though there's been all this conversation, Sandy, about how great a job Ukraine has done, with everything that they've done, Russia continues the onslaught, and it just goes to show that onslaught almost seems to be endless. So, you know, and that's what separates a major nation like Russia from a smaller nation like Ukraine, right? I mean, the fact that it's a major power and Ukraine is not.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the sweet spot that you describe has always been there. The infrastructure is an easy target, quite frankly. And the question is just whether you are willing to pull that plug and pursue that target, because you know what you're doing is
sending the people to death, right?
Yeah, you're also turning the people against you. I mean, the question is, in the outcome of the war, are you expecting to occupy, try to occupy that part of, if Russia were to prevail, what will they do with what they prevail with? And I think that their willingness now to pursue the infrastructure of the western portion of Ukraine suggests to me that really what they're chasing is the eastern part of Ukraine and Crimea, which is what they started out chasing, and that if a settlement is still possible on that basis. And I think that's where the United States is coming down now. You know, General Milley and other people relatively close to the administration are beginning to talk about how it's probably necessary to have discussions and negotiations. And Zelensky is dropping some of the conditions that he had put in for negotiations. And so it does look to me like we're getting to a time period that's quite critical, because it's at this time when there could be a negotiation in which Ukraine might give up any claim to Crimea and yield it to the annexation action that was taken by Russia, and also give up a potentially land path from Russia to Crimea that would include Mariupol, and that could end the war. But if the war goes on a lot longer, if Ukraine, for instance, starts crossing the Dnipro River, starts taking land back that relates to Crimea, then we might find that Ukraine is less likely to make that concession. And at that point, Russia is really cornered, and they could pull out every stop. I mean, regardless of the notion that Russia's badly handled the war, there's no question that they have currently and to date operated the war with some levels of restraint. They didn't attack the infrastructure as directly as they now are. It's very easy to attack the infrastructure. I mean, they're very vulnerable targets, power plants and transmission lines and dams. And so, you know, we're at a critical juncture. And I do think that we're getting to a point right now where it's more likely that there will be active negotiations during these cold months when the military might be restaging rather than enmeshed in warfare.
So the question, Sandy, becomes whether or not America is starting to sense a quagmire for America is... And you kind of even see that Republicans, on the one hand, are looking to say, hey, you know, enough of this. And so they're kind of pushing back. We're getting towards a point of a quagmire for our nation. Is it safe to say that?
Well, yeah. And this whole problem in Poland was symptomatic, and I think it was an example of that Washington could look at, see, feel, and touch of how collateral damage during this war could happen accidentally, but could trigger the potential for direct conflict with Russia, something that we're not interested in generating. And my guess is that Putin's actually not interested in generating it either. But sometimes you have accidental circumstance that create the impression on both sides that now they have to take it up the next level. And if that rocket had been launched from Russia, and even if it had been erroneously launched from Russia and aimed at Ukraine but landed in Poland, we'd have a slightly different situation today, even though it was an accident that everyone could look at and say, yeah, that was accidental. What should we do about it? And so I think that has scared the policymakers in Washington to the point of saying maybe we ought to push harder for negotiation.
You know, Sandy, everyone but Zelensky, who is saying still that he believes it was a Russian missile. And so that's where the quagmire could begin. America is clearly stating what they know to be fact, that this was not Russia. And I understand why Zelensky is saying what he's saying. He knows that he needs NATO's more support and financial support and help. But our nation is clearly stating, hey, whoa, wait a minute. We already know. Because we know if it is Russia's, or if it was Russia's missiles that did that, then NATO would have to respond, meaning the United States.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and we also have come to understand that the
Sandy,
membership...
Hold that thought. We got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back.
Far different than the discussion that's had in Washington and the things they talk about. Because in Washington, they spend all this time talking about things that are kind of social issues. It would be as if we spent our time at our family table talking about other families.
Right.
And, that family up the block that has a transsexual son, you know, we'd spend all sorts of time talking about that issue up there. And we wouldn't be talking, and we aren't talking about how we're spending so much of our money on our defense budget that we can't afford to send the kids to daycare. I mean, that isn't the way we'd be operating. We wouldn't be caring about up the block. We wouldn't worry and extend our nose into the private issues of other families and what they were doing that that didn't matter to us. But our government is spending so much of its time debating things that have that the government has no business having its nose in whatsoever. And is, on the other hand, not debating the things that all of the people of this country have every reason to have their nose in, like, for instance, that audit of the defense budget and how we spend our money on defense and how we formulate our foreign affairs and how we decide how we're going to spend our national treasure.
You know, Sandy, there's no question that these things are important. And the more we don't prioritize them, and I'm not saying that this is something you got to focus on every day, but if we don't focus on certain things, our nation is going to wake up one day, and these decisions that we have not dealt with are going to be at such what's the word I'm looking for, Sandy? A crisis.
Yeah.
You know, and that's when we're going to have to look at it, right? We should be looking at some of these things now.
Yeah, it strikes me that if you again use this family dinner discussion analogy, that from the standpoint of good people, if we all would assume that what we're in, that what we're out to do is achieve goodness for ourselves and our community
and our country,
one of the things we would talk about would be tolerance. We would bring that from what our learnings in church and school, how important it was to be tolerant. And we'd talk to one another about how it is important for us to be tolerant. And that would keep us from being fixated on talking about the issues that might relate to our neighbor, whether our neighbors are a gay couple. Well, we're tolerant. As far as we're concerned,
right,
it's not important to us. We don't need to discuss or debate it, or whether gay marriage is lawful. Of course it's lawful. That couple across the block is a couple of people that we are fond of, we're tolerant of. Tolerance would work us through almost all of these social issues, and we could forget about them because they would be simply a given part of the way we deal with one another. We don't put our nose in other people's business. And what we do worry about are the things that are important to all of us as a community. And that would change the way we talked all together.
You know, Sandy, here's another one. Religious Americans less worried about climate change. So people who claim to be religious believe that God is going to take care of all of that. And we shouldn't be worried about, you know, this world is perfect and God created it in such a manner that there's no way that climate change is ever going to do anything to damage the earth, because the Creator himself has created this where there's nothing that can be done to destroy this perfect creation. Well, you can be a person of religious belief and believe that this deity or your deity or whomever it is, and I would not disagree with you that I believe that there's something greater than myself, and you look at this world and what it is and the perfect balance that it had. But if you think for 1 minute, Sandy, that will remain that way if we don't take some time out based on science and say, hey, look, something is going on. Something is different here. But to just say, well, God's going to take care of it, I mean, I just think, Sandy, you know, we're missing the boat. You know,
But, you know, again, with this concept of tolerance, so I believe that I'll tolerate anyone else's view to the extent they have an independent view. And if their view is based on a religious view rather than a scientific view, maybe that's their problem. Maybe they're misguided. And maybe it will be our problem to the extent that it causes them to vote on issues differently than I would hope they might vote on it. But so long as they aren't trying to impose on me that belief right. that they have, and that's where I think we've run amok in our political debates, is that many people are trying to impose the religious belief they have on others
yes.
through the conduct of the government, okay? And that's where I think we've run amok and where tolerance has turned itself on its head.
You know, Sandy, when you look at what's at the root of these things, and this article was in AP this morning, and it talks about, again, those Americans who claim to be religious, and so it's easy for them, based on their religious beliefs, to say that the climate change, again, is fictitious, because my God is going to take care of all of those things. And so you're right, Sandy, that, okay, people can feel that way, but then don't get upset with other people who say, hey, there's some things going on with the climate that we should be alarmed about. And then wanting to see some movement on that, Sandy. The answer shouldn't be, or if people come back and say, well, you know, God's going to fix that.
Yeah, I mean, to me, what we're talking about, the difference is somebody can believe in creationism, and I'm tolerant, and I'll give them the benefit of being able to believe in it. But what I won't feel comfortable about is if they decide that they want to impose through government a restriction on schools, and to restrict schools from being able to teach anything other than creationism. And that's where we've run amok in the past, and that's where we're running amok now to some extent. And that's where the Supreme Court and courts are now having to deal with this question of, can people try to impose their social view, their ideological view, through restrictions on curriculum, through restrictions on books and the availability of books? I mean, this is a fundamental issue that has come up in our democratic society on numbers of occasions. It's been written about by Orwell and other authors when they've speculated about how we can run amok by trying to impose on others the views that we have and do it through government. And I think that's where we have where we are now running a situation in which people are arguing that they are doing to support the Constitution, they want to take steps which are directly contradictory to the notion of freedom of speech and some of the fundamental freedoms in the Bill of Rights that are built into our Constitution.
You know, Sandy, I never thought of it from that perspective, but you are right. when you start trying to force government to take that up, right?
Yeah,
and force it, on everybody else, right?
Yeah. Yes, which is that fundamentally this notion of this abortion issue fundamentally gets back to this principle, but it's also there for all kinds of other things. The wokeism, the fight in Florida against what is taught in school. I mean, people are certainly free to be to think inconsistently with whatever it is that's being taught or with whatever it is that's being believed. But the question is, can they use the tools of government to constrain the ability of others to consider it?
Which at a different time, they could not get by with that. But for all more and more reason, you see that government is breaking down and giving in.
Those restraints were why we forged our Constitution.
All right, got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. It's Friday. Friday's with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. And you know, listen, I do know, Sandy, that the discussions that we have, these are tender discussions with people and their beliefs and their spiritual beliefs, and so we're not here to try to crush anybody's spiritual beliefs. People have a right to believe whatever it is they want to believe, and that's supposedly what makes our nation different than any other. But we're trying to bring changes to that, Sandy, now. You know, and I don't know, there are people who are trying to change what this nation supposedly was founded under. That people had their rights in what they believed, and that the government would not get in the way of that. But now we're expecting the government to get in the way of it.
Well, it happens periodically. People get swept up in their beliefs and the importance of protecting their beliefs from being eroded by, I guess, for instance, the education process. The Scopes trial, you know, 120 years ago or so, was about, you know, whether you could teach anything but creationism in public schools. And now in Florida, we've got this legislation that was basically sponsored by Governor DeSantis that was to restrict the capacity to teach in schools anything that was apparently what he would describe as woke, and it was this anti-woke kind of restriction.
And the
courts have looked at that, and I think very quickly, at least the first court that's looked at it said, my goodness, this is a kind of restriction on speech and thought that is runs to the heart of our Constitution, and you can't do this. But there is this instinct that I think we have to be alert to, that a reaction to social movements that might be coming from the liberal side and the reaction of the conservatives is to tackle them by imposing government restrictions on that sort of conduct. So, you know, whereas the so-called woke conduct seems to be more of a movement, not a government-imposed kind of a process, the reaction to it is government restrictions. And so we're at the heart of some very fundamental ideological contests in our country. And I think the people who talk most about defending the Constitution should resensitize themselves to what it is the Constitution really stands for.
You know, Sandy, these issues we're talking about are going to be heard at the United States Supreme Court soon, because we're getting to the point where that's where it's going to have to be decided. I thought that these things were already decided, right? I mean, at the beginning, these things were already decided by the Founding Fathers, the separation of these things. And now, you know, that bar has been pushed. And now, at some point in time, the Supreme Court is going to have to settle this.
Well, there has been, you know, if you look at the social movements in the country, there has been an erosion in the number of people who attend church regularly. There's been an erosion of the number of people who will declare themselves affiliated with any particular church. But those who remain affiliated with churches have, I think, become more socially active and more socially strident, and probably feel the notion that the society around them has grown more secular and might put in jeopardy their capacity to raise their children and grandchildren and have them turn out to have the same belief structure that they have. And I think it's those kinds of social conditions that will push conservatives, in particular those with conservative religious views, into thinking that they need to get the government to protect them.
You know, Sandy, it is clear that those who attend a church, mosque, synagogue, temple, those numbers are dwindling. And they're not, and younger people are not replacing those who pass on who had those beliefs. And so I get it. I do. I understand that people are fearful that those beliefs and the way they grew up is in jeopardy. But it can't be a collective. You have a right as an individual to those beliefs, right? As an individual, but you don't have a right as a collective.
Well, that's right. And you know, the there's this kind of crazy conspiracy theory out there that Muslims, when they come to this country and in places like Dearborn, Michigan, where they're numerous, they're going to install Sharia law. With Sharia law right. being the law that is derived from the Quran and is basically religious law, and that's a huge danger. And yet here we have in our country people who are actively trying to get the government to enact more and more laws that would be reflective of religious views. And so, you know, I think we need to stand back and say, look, the reason you're so upset about Sharia law is you don't think that government should have any laws that essentially are an attempt to implement religious views. And we should stand back and say, therefore, should we really have laws that require the Ten Commandments be posted in schools if someone gives a poster to a school that has the Ten Commandments on it? Or whatever, you know, we've got government fiddling, trying to fiddle with social restrictions and social law, and to install by through that fiddling religious views,
it's not a good thing, right? Because where does it end, Sandy? Right, you know.
Yep.
Once and so the government then is going to feel pressured to act in that manner. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to pressure the government to step forward and do this.
And I think it was emboldened. All of this was emboldened by the abortion issue, because there's no question that the abortion issue has been carried fundamentally by a religious right group that considered the issue to be a litmus test of primary importance. And I think the capacity for this country to indulge itself in a debate for so long, which was premised fundamentally on these religious views, has caused us to lose, you know, we've begun to lose the nature, the sense of the border between church and state. And it's gotten fuzzy.
All right, got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. It's Sandy Williams. It's Friday. We'll be right back. I'm about that.